tonight on Arena. Bill Whelan on bringing Riverdance into the world of animation, and Chris Addison on season 2 of the hilarious parenting series Breeders. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Riverdance has been one of the most successful Irish cultural exports of the last half century, the live show having been seen by over 27.5 million people across the world. And Riverdance has now inspired an animated feature film, which will come to Sky Cinema and Now TV on Friday of this week, May the 28th. The film centres on a young boy called Keegan, who has just lost his beloved grandfather, travels to a mystical land then with his best friend, a Spanish-Irish girl called Moya, and there they meet Megalosaurus Giganticus, a character inspired by the ancient Irish giant Red Deer, whose intervention proves a turning point in Keegan's young life. The plot of the music has been inspired by the music and story elements of the original stage production, features a brand new score composed by Bill Whelan, who has brought it to life in partnership with his son, musician and producer Brian Whelan. I'm delighted to have Bill and Brian join me this evening on the programme. Bill, Riverdance, the gift that keeps on giving. When did you realise there was an animated feature in there, or who suggested this idea of the animated feature?
Well, I think it was Moya originally who spoke about the possibility of making some, initially a film arising from Riverdance. And then she spoke with Barry Devlin, I remember, some years ago. And Barry came up with this idea of using animals as the characters. And it grew out from that. Ultimately, Moya went around looking for producers to mount the film, and she ended up in the company, through Barry, actually, I believe, with a company called CineSight, who are based in Montreal and Vancouver and in London. And so began the story. A director called Dave Rosenbaum and another director, Ed Butler, Eamon Butler, who sort of is Dublin originally, but was working in California. They all came together, and with a writer called Tyler Warren, they wrote the story.
And it's beautiful elements of Irish mythology woven into it. Some of which were there present, I suppose, if not on the very surface in the original Riverdance tale, Bill, but some of which have been allowed to grow to become something totally new here.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Riverdance, the show, is that there isn't a narrative tale. It's more a kind of an impressionistic journey of a people out into the world and bringing the music back as it's changed and interacts with other forms. So really, it's not a story. This is a story. This is a story, as you said, and about a young kid. And it's really about his growing up and his facing up to his fears. And, some of the Irish elements that are brought in, like the Newgrange and the Giant's Causeway, you know, it's told beautifully, I think, beautifully animated. There is some animation done in Ireland, but most of it was done in Canada. Mm. And they started with the dancers. The original Riverdance dancers got into motion capture costumes, and using some of the original pieces from Riverdance, they danced, and those dance movements were recorded in a computer, and ultimately transposed onto the animated characters. So you will see, as you beautifully pronounce, Sean, the Megalosaurus Giganticus and a team of ancient Irish elk dancing, but to the genuine Riverdance steps. So it's it's been an interesting journey.
Yeah, certainly that sequence where we see the giant deer dancing on the cliff edge and the hooves banging down, it fits so perfectly with the original, you know, the original hard shoe dance from the show, that, you know, that is a real stroke of genius to put those shoes on animals, the hooves on animals rather, and have them dance.
Oh yeah, and we don't stop with Megalosauri. We move off into frogs and you know, all kinds of animals joining in, and you know, the journey that Keegan makes is, you know, he's led in there by the character of Moya, and she takes him into this place. You know, he's lost his granddad, and he's in mourning, if you like, and she takes him into this place where he faces his fears, and he runs into Patrick, who's the leader of the Megaloceros.
Yeah, there's something beautiful in the fact that, you know, particularly the last year, grandparents, and at the very end of the film, there's a little line for grandparents everywhere, for all our grandparents, something in that line. And it's just lovely that grandparents, the story of grandparents, are so central to the tale that's been told here, as well as the big mythical stuff. It is very much a family tale as well. Maybe this is the perfect moment to bring Brian in, because in fact, Brian, you've been in Ranstone, in your father's home and studio in Ranstone, I think more or less since lockdown began, and grandparenthood is something that he has been experiencing more than once, I think, in the last 12 months. Is that right?
It's actually amazing. I was just listening to you talk about grandparents. I suppose the last year has really been about that for me, because in the January of last year, my wife and I had our firstborn child, and we took a month in Dublin just to settle ourselves down. That was our home. And in mid-February, we came over to, she's from here, and I was coming home to see my grandparents. So our son was going to meet both his grandparents. And then a few weeks after we got down here, like many people, we got locked down where we were. And then the work started. And it was a story very much about grandparents. So it's definitely been a grandparents, grandchildren year for us in Ranstone.
Yeah, I would have thought, just to explain to me a little bit about how the process between yourself and your father, Bill, then, how that worked, because your background is very much in music anyway, Brian.
That's right. Yeah, I've mistakenly followed him into the business. Dad and I have worked in the past we had done the Riverdance, the 25th anniversary album, just the year previously. So it was all very fresh in our minds when this project came around. I had done, I acted as mixing engineer and producer or recording engineer on the album, and then the project of the movie came around, and we kind of got back into gear, and it was really fun to approach it from a completely different angle and kind of throw a whole new color on the music. It was pretty magic.
And there were kind of two sides to this, Bill. There was old music from the show and older music that older music from the show that had to be kind of reworked slightly or looked at again and maybe rearranged in some ways. But you also had to do a number of totally new compositions. Was that a first? Is this more or less a first for you in terms of animated work, Bill? You know, to write specific.
No,
go ahead.
Yeah. Absolutely, Sean. It was. I mean, I have done small, pieces to animation, but never something of this scale. And it's very interesting when you mention this. Like, we've talked about it. I've done music for dramas, for film, but this, the difference between this and, shall we say, a feature film with actors, is that. When you come to a film with actors, you're generally, as the composer, you're late into the project. You know, in fact, William Goldman, in his book Adventures in the Screen Trade, refers to the composer as the last welder on the ship. And it is really that last moment when it all comes together. The acting's been done, a lot of the rough editing's been done. But in this particular project, you know, we were there right from the very beginning, apart from having written some of the music that was danced to, then all of the additional music, and there's probably an hour of additional music or near enough of new music, plus the music from the original score of the show. Yeah. So, like, we were there from the beginning, and then Brian, he not alone did he record most of what we're hearing, but then he also mixed. He did at the end of the film. There are two items. One of them is a new song which Lyra and I wrote together, and which Brian produced and arranged. And then he also did a remix, a kind of contemporary dance remix, because Keegan actually in the film is a character who, you know, he likes to, he's a big vinyl fan and he does a bit of mixing.
Yeah.
So Brian took the opportunity to ruin his father's music by doing a remix of it. It's actually very exciting, I have to admit. And it's
good.
All of this has come together with the as you refer to it. I wasn't sure I liked the word, the old music, and then the new stuff. It's been quite a trip, and Lyra contributed brilliantly to it.
Yeah, well, the more established music is quite definitely there, or the better known music is quite definitely there. I promise I won't use the word old again. Let's go to a totally new piece, as far as I'm aware. I don't think Log Walk and Keegan in the Rapids existed in the previous Riverdance show. We'll just listen to this. I'm telling you, Log Walk, Keegan is the young boy's name in the Rapids. So you know he's on a log and you know that he's in the rapids on a river. So I think the rest will be delivered to you by the music itself. Just so beautiful, and you really can see the action, even if you haven't seen the film version, this animated version of Riverdance that we're talking about. When I said to you a log walk and then a young fella in the rapids, you can actually see it in front of you. It's so different, the type of music, I'm presuming, Bill Whelan, when you're composing for animated work like this. You really are, you know, we can hear splashes in the water there and how you react to them with a cymbal crash or something like that. You really have to accent things aurally that we've already seen visually.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd like to just pay tribute to there were a team of four of us kind of intimately in the music here, apart from a music editor who was based in London, Mark Wilshire. But there was Brian Masterson who mixed the final mix to picture, and David Downs. David and I did the orchestrations together, and David did an absolutely brilliant job at both pairing the tracks and then doing the orchestrations. It was really we worked very, very intimately over months and months, and in fact, we met every Tuesday on Zoom, all of us, like the director, the two directors, and some of the creative team. And the music team, and we played the music that I would have written in that week. Everybody got a chance to respond to it. So and sometimes the picture was changing, Sean. Yeah. You know, sometimes they say, "Oh yeah, do you remember that bit? Well, actually, we've taken that out now. We've done this." So you had to be able to react quickly.
Yes.
So we did, and the process was it was very much a collaborative process. Everybody working together all the time.
The other thing, Brian, I think that you are pretty involved in this, in the actual recording then of the music for the film, for what is the finished score, what we hear when we're looking at the screen. David Brophy was conducting here now. Again, COVID restrictions only gave you two choices in terms of where it could be done. But you were in Roundstone, yourself and your dad were in Roundstone. Were they recording it? Was it in Vienna that they were recording? And you were, it was almost as if you were in the room. Such was the nature of the technology. It wasn't just Zoom. This was Zoom on steroids, I believe you may have described it as. A seriously high-tech way of being right in contact with what was happening in the recording studio at that moment.
That's right. It's a piece of software called Source Connect, and we were able to connect directly with the stage in Vienna. And it was there was absolutely no latency. We were able to record instantly and communicate back and forth. So the day was, it really was almost as though we were there, but obviously we weren't here. And it was completely seamless. I can't believe it was how easily it was able to be done, and how freely we were able to David Downes' dad and myself were so easily able to communicate with everyone there. And it really was as if we were in Vienna.
I know it's quite extraordinary how what was born out of necessity in some ways has now shown us things we can do and enabled us to connect maybe in ways that we didn't think were possible. There are some positives that come from all of this.
Just to say this, that Brian also, because there are traditional musicians involved in the score as well, we were hidebound by COVID as well here. So everybody, people like Zoe Conway, the people in the States, Pat Mangan, and they recorded remotely. Brian would send out the tracks to them. They'd play on the tracks and he'd bring them back in and mix them in with the rest of the music. So it was really, there was a lot of movement around the world with this music until it eventually arrived.
Without anyone actually moving.
Exactly. The other thing, just another quick thing about when we were examining where we might do it, I had two options. One was in New Zealand and the other was in Vienna. And I called up a guy I know, most Dublin musicians of a certain seniority would remember, Dennis O'Sullivan, who was teaching in the Hochschule in Vienna. And I said to him, I called him up and I said, look, I'm hearing that there's a place in Vienna where we can record. And he said, well, look, I don't do that anymore. He said, but I can certainly put you in touch with somebody. And I said, well, like who? And he said, what about the leader of the Vienna Symphony, Radio Symphony? And I said, yeah, that sounds like somebody who would really know. And he said, you can call her there. And I said, well, does she speak English? He said, yeah, it's Mairead McCran.
Stop.
So we suddenly found that the Paddies were starting to appear in Vienna, and there were several Irish in the orchestra, and it was a 70-piece orchestra, and Brophy, as usual, was superb when he went out to conduct.
Yeah, Mairead McCran, of course, the violinist, and she obviously based in Vienna. Well, listen, lovely to speak with the two of you this evening. Given what Brian has just explained about the nature of technology, meaning you don't have to move anywhere. You might have a house guest for a little bit longer than you had originally reckoned last February, Bill. You can talk to your father about that afterwards if you want, Brian.
No, Sean, we had to move out eventually. We're renting nearby now.
Yeah, all right. Okay, so you're down the road.
We're down the road.
For the sake of harmony, let's just say. Bill, will you lead us into the little section that I want to finish up with, which is the section that talks about the Giants card that is played as we're in the Giants Causeway?
Yes, I will. Sean, the Megaloceros, Patrick, the main Megaloceros Giganteus, leads Keegan out and he takes him to the Giants Causeway and he tells him some mythic tales. John Kavanagh appears to lead Keegan into the mythic world. And in this, I've reprised some of the original Riverdance music, but in a completely different setting. The song "Lift the Wings" is here in this as part of this sequence. So that's it.
Original was the word, obviously, I was searching for earlier on. Thanks, Bill. Great to speak to you this evening. Sequence there called Giant's Causeway from the music for Riverdance, the animated adventure. Bill Whelan and his son Brian speaking to us about the music for that film. And Bill mentioned some of the voices involved. John Kavanagh is in there, Aisling Bee, Paulie McGlynn, Pierce Brosnan, Brendan Gleeson is in there as well. Some fine vocal acting talent involved. And you can see Riverdance, the animated adventure. It'll be coming to Sky Cinema and Now TV from Friday of this week, May 28th. Chris Addison rose to fame as a stand-up comedian and for his role as political advisor Ollie Reader in the biting satirical series The Thick of It. His latest TV project, Breeders, co-created with Martin Freeman and Simon Blackwell, returns to our TV screens tomorrow evening for its second season. Breeders follows parents Paul, played by Martin Freeman, and Ali, played by Daisy Haggard, as they try to juggle full-time careers, a mortgage, their own relationship, and the trials and tribulations of raising kids. Well, earlier I spoke to Chris Addison, and I began by asking him about how the kernel of the idea for Breeders came into being when the actor, Martin Freeman, had a dream.
He did. He's not the first Martin to have a dream, and it's not the most important dream Martin has ever had, but he did indeed have a dream. And the dream became sort of the first scene of that first season, which was of bedlam upstairs in the house, small children making an absolute racket, and Martin walking upstairs, sort of giving himself a pep talk, saying, you don't have to do this. You can be better than this. You don't have to shout. You can deal with this another way. And then opening the door and screaming his head off at the kids. And he woke feeling that that was that sort of represented a thing that you don't often see expressed or shown, particularly not in comedy, which is that idea that on the one hand, there's nothing that you love more than your children, nothing. But on the other hand, there's nothing that has the potential to make you angrier than and frustrated than your own kids.
Yeah, you know.
And so that's really what the show is about.
Yeah, because everybody tells you, oh, when you see your children, you'll be in love. You'll never experience love like this. Yeah. They don't tell you the other side of that coin, really, do they? And none of us really tell anybody
precisely.
Else about it.
No, and in fact, you know, the best response that we've had to the show is parents, and this has been the overwhelming one, is parents saying to us, thank God you said that. Thank God somebody said that, and I don't feel like it's just me. Because you can go crazy with the feeling that you're doing something wrong because you're feeling that way about your children. And obviously, you know, Paul is on the sort of extreme end of the scale for dramatic reasons, but nonetheless, that is definitely a universal thing that parents generally feel. We felt it was sort of a juicy area to explore.
Certainly was and certainly is. Paul, played by Martin Freeman, Ali, his wife and the mum of the two kids in question, played by Daisy Haggard. What really struck me about this was, you know, I thought there are times when they were both had absolutely polar opposite opinions and they were both right. And there were times when they had absolutely polar opposite opinions and they were both totally wrong. There is no right and wrong here.
No, I mean, that's the thing. There's no kind of the problem. It sounds like such a cliche and such a sort of a mimsy thing to say, hey, there's no rehearsal for life. We know that. We know there's no rehearsal for life. But actually, you know, you only discover how you went wrong by doing the things. But by that point, it is way too late. And that is how you mess your own children up. With going into parenting with the best possible intentions, you cannot get everything right. And you can read all the books you want to, but nothing will sort of prepare you for the actuality that your children will present you with.
And you, as one of the co-creators, Simon Blackwell and Martin Freeman, were all coming from a position of the voices of experience on this one.
Yeah, definitely. You know, when we sat down to begin with to try and figure out whether there was a show in this and what that show might be, it was a really interesting experience for us because, you know, three white, middle-class, middle-aged men, British, English men, no less, you know, pretty hidebound, talking about this stuff was just something we'd never done. But in creating the show, we had to kind of open up to each other and talk about it. Very quickly, it became clear that the meetings that we were having were operating slightly as therapy sessions. And that vibe has sort of gone into the writer's room. So now pretty much everybody that we have in our writer's room for the first two seasons in particular are parents. And so we start really each season by sitting down and talking about our darkest fears and our biggest the most guilt ridden that we've felt about things. We talk about experiences and feelings and it's incredibly sort of open and it is a form of therapy. Yeah. But it's also why I think the show gets the reaction it does from people. That's why it feels honest, is because it all comes from a place of of real openness.
And that's, you mentioned three white middle-class men sitting down together, but the writer's room has more than three people in it. Not everybody's white, not everybody's middle-class, and I sincerely hope not everybody is a man.
No, well, we have a writer's room where we were super aware that the easy thing for this show, given who has created it, it would be very simple for it to become man has midlife crisis, you know.
Yeah.
And we never wanted that to happen. So it was very important to us that the writer's room be, you know, strongly female. So in fact, you know, the writer's room that we've just had, there are six people writing in that room, and two of them are men and four of them are women. And it's really important to keep an eye on, particularly Ali, Daisy Haggard's character, because it would be very simple to make that character a standard kind of buzzkill sitcom, oh, guys, character if you wrote her wrong. So we've got people making sure that, you know, that her point of view is properly represented.
Yeah. There's also a lovely representation of the grandparents in this, and I want to go to a clip from the new season featuring just that. Martin Freeman, playing the character of Paul, is over at his mum and dad's, and he's helping them to get their new enormous telly working. And he's talking to his mum, played by Joanna Bacon, his dad, played by the wonderful Alan Armstrong, about an argument they've had with their son, Luke, who's now, he's just about to turn 13. They've cancelled his 13th birthday. Language plays a very important role in the series, and it plays a very big role in this clip. We'll talk about how the language works and why you do that, but be warned, there is plenty of language to be heard in the midst of this.
You can't cancel Luke's birthday, Paul. Cancelling a child's birthday? Are you in a fucking Roald Dahl book?
He pushed us too far, Dad. Ali and I are both agreed on this.
No, you're not.
What do you fucking know, Yuri Geller?
I know you two are decent people. Loving parents. You got pushed into a corner and you couldn't back down. But now you're both feeling horrible and weird about it.
Oh, she blows!
Houston, we have a pitcher.
Oh, God, it's Houston, Dad, not Houston. It's a fucking huge telly, by the way.
Oh, our eyes are not what they were. I mean, they've always been eyes, they just don't work as well as they did.
So we wanted to get the latest TV, embrace technology. We're not giving in to old age. We're not surrendering.
Oh, good. Oh, by the way, would you two be able to pick up Ava for the next few days while we sort something out?
Yeah, of course.
Thanks.
You don't think...
What?
Don't get cross.
You know I can't guarantee that.
Well, you don't think you and Ali are scared of Ava growing up, so you're still treating her like a child?
She is a child.
Well, she's very mature for her age, Paul. Very sensible.
So you think she should walk home from school by herself?
Yes, I do. And have a phone.
I thought your generation all thought phones were evil.
Like we said, we want to embrace technology. Phones are useful things. All human knowledge in your pocket. And Scrabble.
Where could you go without your Scrabble in your pocket? That's Alan Armstrong as the dad there of Martin Freeman's character, and also Joanna Bacon as his mum in a scene there from the first episode of season two of Breeders, and co-creator Chris Edison's is with me on talking about the thing this evening, or in fact this morning, and I'll explain why I'm saying that in a minute. But I wanted to pick up on a couple of things in that. First of all, this idea, he talks there about the daughter's growing up and the parents trying to stop her. I think the children in this season are probably closer to the age of your kids now than, because in the first season we were basically dealing with very young kids, and you were well past that stage. Are you closer to the kind of 10 and 13 point now that the characters are here?
Yes, my children are actually a tiny bit older than Luke and Ava are in this season. But when we started talking about this season, they were pretty much the ages of the kids. Yeah, absolutely. And what we wanted to do by moving the ages on a few years, because, you know, in the previous season, Ava was, what, 5 and Luke was 8. We'd always planned from the outset that we wanted to show different phases of parenting, different stages of life of the kids, and how you have to be as a parent for each of those. Because if you want to do a show that's an examination of parenting, you have two options. You either do that, or you go in early and hope you stick around for 12 years or whatever. But we didn't really, you know, we didn't want to do that. So we moved the kids on. Also, it's a big it sort of helps us creatively by not helping us creatively, in that it gives us more of a challenge, you know, to... When we went back to the writer's room at the beginning of season two, we basically had to write two new characters, but well, one and a half maybe, because little Luke, little 8-year-old Luke in season one, we sort of knew that he was an anxious kid and all of those kinds of things. And that is fleshed out a little bit in 13-year-old Luke. In fact, it's fleshed out a lot. It's a lot of the engine of this series. Whereas Ava, 5-year-old Ava, was a sort of little box of fireworks in the corner of the room that occasionally a match would fall into and would explode. But she didn't really, you know, because she's played by wonderful little actress Jada Ailes, who, you know, herself was only five at the time. Mm. There's not an awful lot of weight you can put on an actress of that age. So we had to kind of create Ava anew, which was a useful challenge for us.
Yeah, and brings it, I suppose it opens up a whole new set of topics. I mentioned
absolutely.
I mentioned language before we went into that clip. Of course,
you're
no stranger to the world of language. If we start talking about the thick of it, people will remember you as Ollie Reader in the thick of it. You've been through so many different aspects of your career. Let's listen to a clip from the thick of it, where Malcolm is visiting your character, Ollie, Malcolm played by Peter Capaldi, visiting Ollie in hospital. Ollie's just had an appendix operation, but Malcolm has somebody in his sights. Be warned, Malcolm likes to use very bad language.
We're putting Nicola on a train today to Bradford. It's the closest I could get to Lochner in a metal box.
Well, this is the hear-to-hear thing. A great idea. Going around the country, listening to people tell you that they hate you. It's just in different accents. I fucking hate you.
I hate you.
I fucking hate you.
So, wait, today's the day?
Today's the day. While she's on the train, I'm going to detonate the main bomb. But I need you to set one off later.
Malcolm, I'm in hospital. I'm not wearing any pants.
I don't care if you've been dead for a year and playing cribbage with Jimmy fucking Savile. I want you to make a bomb and explode it today.
This is a metaphorical bomb, right?
This is it, Jack fucking Bauer. Time for you to embrace your inner bastard. I'll be in touch, right? That wee nurse needs cheering up.
Nice. Really nice, Malcolm. Those are my flowers.
Easy come, easy go.
Peter Capaldi as Malcolm, Chris Addison as Ollie there in a scene from the thick of it. Yeah, language was a big thing in that series as well, for sure, Chris Addison.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, the thing about, well, there are a couple of things there. One is people used to say to us, why do they swear so much in the thick of it? And the truth is, it's because it's people under pressure. And people under pressure, that's sort of what often happens to their language. I know there are some people who manage to live life without doing that kind of thing. And good for those people. But for an enormous number of us, that's when bad language tends to come out. I always felt with the thick of it, though, that the most entertaining language was not the straightforward swear words. It was the much more kind of filigree insults and kind of that sort of the wonderful images that Malcolm in particular used to paint, sometimes kind of violent and horrific, but always kind of vaguely poetic and funny. And I suppose in Breeders, we're looking at people who are under pressure as well. And also we're not moralizing with Breeders. Mm. We're not trying to show a perfect family. In fact, we're trying to show that people are flawed and that's okay to be flawed. And so putting the kind of language that it might be that, you know, maybe we're very sweary people. It hadn't really occurred to me before I started to answer this question, but putting the kind of language in that we would say to one another seemed important to us, you know.
Ah, so are you feeling sorry then for poor politicians and poor politicians' advisors who are under pressure? I mean, there's one particular man under possibly a bit of pressure this morning as he's in front of the Health and Science Committee as we speak. I'm talking about Dominic Cummings, of course. How much does life imitate art when it comes to this type of thing for you, particularly in the political realm?
Well, I think that life has very much moved on from the time that we were making the thick of it. I think the political world that you would be depicting now, if you were to start a similar sort of show, would be very different, because the thing that we were satirizing was the distance between the competence that they were trying to project and the incompetence that they were trying to disguise, you know? And the show sort of existed in the space between those two things. Now, post 2016, all bets are off. You know, we in the UK have a cabinet of staggeringly, I mean, stupid people. Like, the lack of talent, politics aside, the lack of talent amongst our politicians is remarkable. And the notion that they're projecting any kind of competence has gone. It's that's all fallen down. Any kind of facade that politicians were attempting to construct back then, that has long fallen over, and we're looking at the horrific mess behind. You know, so it feels to me like when you look back at the politics and the political world and machinations of the era of the thick of it, it seems like sort of halcyon days in comparison to where we find ourselves now.
One final question on Breeders, Chris, before we finish up. I don't know what the intention was with the series. I've seen the first four episodes of season two. I laughed out loud and I wept bitterly into my hanky at times as well. Was that your intention, that we would feel both of those emotions? Because I really did swing between both, very moving and very funny.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so pleased to hear that, Sean, because that is exactly what we were going for. The important thing for us with this, obviously, first and foremost, it's a sitcom, so it always has to be funny. But we wanted it to be such that if you were to take all the jokes and the funny situations out, the drama of it, all the dramatic beats would work, all the emotional beats would work, and it would feel honest and truthful and like it was representing something that you believed. And we wanted to kind of put the viewers through the ringer. So you've seen, I think, the first four episodes, and I can assure you that things only get trickier from there on. You know, at the end of season one, we had a situation where Luke had meningitis, and his parents didn't know whether he was going to survive or not. And we wanted to, you know, see what it was like if you put a child in mortal peril, what that's like for the parents. But you know, at the same time, it's a trick for sure. It's a hard one to pull off to make that funny. But the truth is that life is very bleak and life is very funny, and it is both of those things at the same time. Those things can absolutely exist together. And so, yeah, we always wanted to make our show have those live alongside one another.
And you gave us such a wonderful cliffhanger at the end of episode four of season two. I have to see episode five. I'm not going to even mention it. But, Chris, lovely to speak with you. Thanks a million for being with us.
You too, man.
That's Chris Addison, and Breeders season two starts on Sky One, also available on Now TV from tomorrow. Scottish band Texas return this Friday with a new album. It's called, quite simply, Hi. It's one of three we will be reviewing as part of our weekly album review slot, alongside English band Black Midi and also Kelly Okereke of Block Party fame. For a flavour of the upcoming Texas album, here's the current single. It's called Moonstar.
You're hiding in the back room, dancing's on the rise. Feel the cold wind blow and it's coming from all sides. Barefoot in the back streets, shadows on the floor. Take out little Annie cause she's heading out the door. Everybody knows only you can stop her now. Maybe that's cause you know how.
Moonstar from Texas, and that's a track from their new album. We will be reviewing that, as I said, one of three on Friday, the other being from Black Midi, the other from Kelly Okereke of Block Party fame. Trouble is the third short story collection from Philip O'Kelly, a writer and translator now living in Bucharest. Love and danger are abiding themes in the lives of his usually male narrators, themes that crop up in previous story collections as well. In 2016, O'Kelly translated the writer Michael Sebastian's novel For 2,000 Years into English. It's the true story of the author's life as a Jew in Romania in the 1920s. Delighted to have Philip O'Kelly join us on the programme this evening. Let's start, if we can, Philip, with, in fact, the title story of this new collection. And two men with serious taste in literature, it has to be said. Maybe give us an idea of your security guard here and his boss, a guy called Garrity from Newry.
Hello, Sean. Hello, yeah. I wrote that story actually, because it describes how the narrator has to run away from Ireland because he steals some money from his boss, who's a gangster in Dublin. The reason I wrote it was I live in Bucharest. I have done for the past 20 years, and I got kind of tired of people asking me why I came here and why I stayed. So I decided to just write this story. And anytime anyone asks me, as journalists do here sometimes, I just direct them there.
Straight to that story, Trouble. I'm presuming that...
Yeah, so it's called Trouble, but it's actually to save me trouble.
Well, tell us then, were you having fun then by putting these guys, as I said, we mightn't necessarily associate a security man at night and a gangster with 19th century Russian literature, but they're carrying the books about in their back pockets. Sometimes I thought maybe just to show off the titles, but they seem to read them and have discussions about them as well.
Yeah, they do. I had a lot of fun with that particular story, actually. It mixes together some autobiographical things. I actually worked as a security guard on a night shift in Dublin. That was my last job before I left the country and went to Romania. So I actually didn't give up much. Sometimes people think, you know, it's terrible trials to come over to a foreign country and try to make a living writing short stories. But it wasn't actually that great back in Ireland either.
I'm wondering, though, you say 20 years you've been there at this stage, and I mentioned in the introduction about your translation of Mikhail Sebastian's novel for 2,000 years. You translated it into English. So obviously you're familiar with the language at this point in time. Have you written in Romanian, or has your relationship with English changed over that 20 years?
I've written shopping lists in Romanian. I've been out of Ireland I'm 53 now. I've been out of Ireland for the past over three decades and learning different languages. So I haven't forgotten it entirely. At the moment, I have a daughter. She's 9, and I speak to English. I speak in English with her. She doesn't let me speak Romanian with her.
All right.
I make mistakes, and I have a funny accent, and she doesn't like that. So I don't forget entirely how to speak English, thanks to her.
Yes, but you're not tempted to bring the other languages to the page, are you?
It's hard enough writing in English.
Fair enough. Let me talk about another story.
Go on.
Let me talk about another story, which is called Island. Because a lot of your narrators, they're pretty isolated, and they are lone figures and lone wolves in many ways. What's the situation of the young man in Ireland or on Ireland in some ways?
That's a fantastical story. And I like it in that it's told in a very detailed way. The land is described, and he's setting up a little farm. At the same time, it's some quite fantastical things happen. And there's a distinct possibility that he might be mad. So these different elements it's a nice mix to have in a story, because the reader doesn't exactly know how to take it, and then it's all over.
Yes, yeah, that's precisely the nature of it. I was kind of getting, I think, I kind of have a handle on this, and then it's all over, literally all of a sudden. There's another story, however, that... very interesting juxtaposition of what you give us in First Love. This is a semi-fictional account of the diaries of Felix Landau, Austrian Nazi leader in the SS. You're talking about his first love. Give us a sense of who that man was, first of all.
That story, well, I suppose it's nearly an act of plagiarism, because... it's based upon the actual diaries of a Nazi war criminal that I read in translation in the library in Munich a few years ago. And I was just so taken aback by it that I had to steal it somehow and make it mine. The diaries were actually used during the trial of this war criminal, because he was involved in massacres. He ran the Jewish ghetto of a Polish town in the years of the Holocaust, until they were actually sent to an extermination camp. But what really struck me about this story was that his actual duties and the things he was charged with eventually were in his diaries, very much in a second place to his emotional life and his love story. He'd just fallen in love with a woman and he was parted from her, and this caused him great pain. And it struck me so much, this puzzle of this man with his, you know, his great love affair, at the same time his utter cruelty to the people who were under his power, that I knew it was something I could never make up without being accused of some kind of terrible cynicism or trying to strain for a certain effect. So I knew I had to steal it and have at least the backup that it was a real story.
Yeah, because I suppose the question that would be asked was, you know, what are you doing giving this this war criminal, essentially, what are you doing giving him this lovely, you know, teenager story of losing his first love, and we feel sympathy for him for that. And then in the next breath, he's giving us a paragraph of very cold, clinical description of the thousands of people that he's murdering on a daily basis, having a basis.
Well, that's
in
the puzzle, and that's the challenge. That's the challenge. That throws it to the reader, who, you know, we live in a culture where we're primed by the word love to not analyze, to try to presume that people who are in love are somehow better than people who aren't, or somebody who might love someone sincerely and really want to take care of them is somehow automatically going to be a good person who's not going to do bad things. And in other departments of their lives, you know, it's just romantic nonsense.
One final question. Will you continue to be in love yourself with the short story form, where you're into your third collection? Any ideas around a novel? Or are you happy to stick with the shorter form?
I've no wish to do a novel. I've written a few novels, but I chop them down in order to satisfy myself that they're good stories.
Well,
so long as someone will keep publishing my stories, I don't see any reason to write a novel.
And continue with the chopping then, in that case, Philip. Thanks for speaking to us this evening. That's Philip O'Callaghan speaking to us about his third collection of poetry, or of short stories rather, which is called Trouble, and it's published by Stinging Fly. And that is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. I will talk to you tomorrow night, once again, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1.